Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn. Welcome to episode 260 of Troubadours and Raconteurs with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we have as our featured guest, Brad McConnell, presently the Chief Executive Officer of nonprofit organization Acción, a leader in microlending. And Mr. McConnell talks with us about how he got to be the leader of such an operation and why microlending is important to our communities, especially those underserved. We also talk a little bit about the time he spent as a deputy director for this sort of work underneath the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel. It's a great conversation about a very important new way to give more people access to money and support so they can be entrepreneurs and create jobs and such. The American dream, as it were, grassroots style. Good conversation today with Brad McConnell on the program. We have an EW essay titled Morrison and another wonderfully crafted and beautifully read essay by our associate producer and resident essayist, Uncle Cesare, a.k.a. Dr. Michael Pavese. That one is titled The Notebooks of Brad O'Leary. We have a poem called Freakin' Mall. And all of this, as is always the case, will be imbued and infused with a wonderful energy via several great tunes. It's nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 260 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
Rage that you harnessed on me.
Morrison. We citizens of the United States of America fancy ourselves the most advanced people on the planet. We are the best at everything, except, of course, the things that do not matter much. The other day I was driving and noticed the power lines hanging, really dangling from pole to pole. It is so unsightly, though, you know, it would cost too much to put them underground like so many neighborhoods in countries far and wide manage to do, even those shithole places. It makes sense to let the electric company do what they figure is best here across the U.S. The ridge tops of these old Appalachian mountains have been skewered and tangled with 40-foot poles and power cables, right through neighborhoods, too, all so that energy will be brought to market someplace else. This, I suppose, is not what is meant by the phrase, power to the people. Damn the beauty. Who cares about the health-related questions associated with electromagnetic waves? No one asked me. Aren't these my mountains, too? On to a more inspired thought. How about those young patriots fighting with reason, passion, and resilience, the gun lobby and their political puppets? That is the type of power I see as healthy and progressive.
On Love Street, lingers long on Love Street. She has a house and garden. I would like to see what happens. She has robes and she has monkeys, lazy diamond studded flunkies. She has wisdom and knows what to do. She has me and she has you. There's the store where the creatures meet. I wonder what they do in there. Summer Sunday and a year. I guess I like it fine so far. Long on Love Street. She has a house and garden. I would like to see what happens. La 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 la
Hello, Brad McConnell. This is EW Conundrum from Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for being on the program, sir. Before we get started with our conversation, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to give our listeners some background. And here we go. Brad McConnell is Chief Executive Officer of Axion Chicago, a nonprofit that creates jobs and wealth in the communities that need them most by providing capital, coaching, and connections to neighborhood entrepreneurs. As the largest microlender in Illinois and Northwest Indiana, Axion Chicago serves thousands of clients annually and has made over 5,000 small business loans, totaling $42 million since its founding in 1994. Appointed CEO in April 2017, Brad McConnell brings more than two decades of financial and economic development experience to his role. For 5 years, he was Deputy Commissioner and Chief Operating Officer at the City of Chicago's Department of Planning and Development, where he managed five units that supported the city's development priorities from initial urban planning to final deal closure and community growth. Prior, he served as Economic Policy Advisor to Illinois Senator Dick Durbin in Washington, D.C. Previous assignments included supporting small business bankers as Vice President at LaSalle Bank, now Bank of America, and leading strategy, process, and technology projects in the U.S. and Europe at Accenture. He previously served as Axion's Board of Directors and currently serves as Chairman of the local school council and head youth basketball coach at Audubon Elementary School and on the Board of Directors at the food incubator, The Hatchery. Ladies and gentlemen, Brad McConnell on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. Thank you so much for taking time out, sir.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks. That was quite a long list.
Yeah,
shorten that up a little bit.
No, it's very impressive. It's very good. It gives people some context. And I like to start off by asking you, when you worked for the City of Chicago, which mayor did you work for?
The current mayor, Mayor Emanuel.
That's what I thought. That must have been pretty intense. He's a pretty intense man.
I'll say yes to both of those observations. It was a really great experience, and one which I recommend to anybody who's public, civically minded, just to work for the city in the capacity in which you can really do good things, particularly if you're working with somebody who works as hard as Mayor Emanuel does. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, what was it like working for the city? You know, in a government sort of capacity, was it pretty complicated in terms of trying to navigate through the different, parts of government as well as the communities?
It was fascinating, and I guess two observations. The first is that in my previous role before that, where I was working in the Senate in Washington, moving from that to municipal government, although under the banner in both cases of economic development, it was fascinating to see the differences in both the day-to-day work that I needed to do and then the way that you can evaluate the impact that you're having for all of the hours that you're spending. Where before, working in Washington, as you expect, it was sort of a national and international policy in which you're setting broad parameters for things to take place, and then you just hope that things actually happen in the way that the laws have been set out to work. Whereas at the municipal level, we were dealing with literally the dirt in which you're trying to figure out, in some cases, what is the best way for sojourner economic activity at the corner of X and Y. And that's just a whole different set of tasks that are necessary. And you can feel the impact because you can see it when you're doing that sort of very, very localized development. And you get, as you said, you get to meet with, and this is probably the most fun part of the job, smart people from all over the city who are working hard to improve their own communities. And the job is to figure out how to be helpful, to help the people who are doing good work to do more of it.
And I suppose you live in Chicago. Now, maybe you're from Chicago. It's more of a sense of home, I'd imagine, than maybe when you're in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, it goes both ways. Where I moved up here right after undergrad, so I've been off and on in Chicago for, 25 years now, dating myself a little bit. And so on the one hand, when you're working in Washington, you're representing the people back home. In my case, since I was in the Senate, it was the whole state of Illinois, and so you take big pride in that. But on the other hand, if you're actually living in and serving the city of Chicago, then it's much more tangible and visceral because you are, in fact, right here. And you can see on a day-by-day basis the impact that you're having on the people that you know and that you run into at the grocery store. You know, it's different.
Yeah, and you know, the experience that you have it at the municipal level, as you mentioned, at the federal level, and I'm sure in between, you know, you work with the state. It's a must, too, to be at either level to get things done. And now you're more or less, I guess it's the private sector, or is it sort of a synthesis with the Action Chicago?
In between. So if you think about the three sectors of public, private, and nonprofit, I'm now running a nonprofit, and it's my first experience in working in the nonprofit sector after starting in the private sector and then working in the public sector. And so that in and of itself has been interesting and a really good learning experience. But there are lots of similarities and then many, many differences between participating in or running a nonprofit and either of the other two modes. And so there's certain benefits, certainly, for the freedom that's afforded a nonprofit that's not municipally government, is not sort of dedicated to what the voters are exactly asking for and what the politicians are asking for. But by the same way, it's not profit motivated, whereby we're not trying to generate returns for shareholders either. And so it's a nice medium place in which we get to do good work and have more flexibility to get it done right.
And that work we're talking about basically or mainly is to do with funding, micro-lending, and that's where we want to go next in our conversation, if you don't mind. What is micro-lending? That's mainly what you're doing, I understand.
Yeah, we do three things, but we're most known for the first of those. So we provide capital and coaching connections to help entrepreneurs grow, as you said in the introduction. But the capital side of it is providing small-dollar loans to neighborhood entrepreneurs that banks would typically not be able to serve. So to give you a flavor for that, unlike your local branch of a bank, whether that be a national institution or whether it be just a local bank or credit union, most of the time you'll find it very rare that a bank would be able to do a business loan less than $100,000. The economics just simply don't work for banks to be able to make loans at that level because they can't make money on those. So fair enough. We, on the other hand, are structured such that we focus exclusively on those types of loans, and so we make loans anywhere between $500 at the very low end and $100,000 at the high end in an attempt to fill in that growth gap for helping small businesses that need capital for whatever purpose that they need to grow, but that just can't get it from traditional financing sources, just given the startup nature of the business or just the small needs that they have. We'll make it happen in a way that they will struggle generally to find from another source.
And how do you get your money to lend? Where does that come from?
There's a variety of sources. We have really good relationships with financial institutions who want to make investments in underserved neighborhoods but just don't have the structure to do so. Frankly, lots of financial institutions need to anyway because of the regulations under the Community Reinvestment Act, which require banks that have some footprint in a neighborhood to make a specific set of investments in those neighborhoods. We make that easy for banks because if they partner with us, then we do the lending and the coaching, and they therefore just get the credit for that because they're helping us financially to do so. So there's that. We work with thoughtful foundations that are both national and local in nature. We also work with corporate philanthropy. And then beyond all of that, we manage a tight balance sheet. And so we work with lenders in order to provide us low-cost capital we in turn then can lend to borrowers who are small business owners at a slightly higher rate, and then we just sort of make do with the spread in between. So in many respects, it's fairly traditional in the way that we fund, except for we also have to fund beyond the normal sort of borrow at a lower amount and lend at a higher amount because we need to also then create a subsidy, which we get via grants, in order to make it such that we can make loans that other people won't make because of the inherent risk and the lack of economies of scale at the very, very small dollars that we're lending.
And when you say risk, is it are these folks too higher risk to default, usually?
Yes, and so that is our mission. We will make loans and intentionally try to make loans to entrepreneurs that other financial institutions simply won't serve. So what that looks like in practice for us is that we dedicate a substantial proportion of our time and energy trying to serve entrepreneurs on the west and south and southwest sides of Chicago that have typically been underinvested in. And so that inherently has different risks than you would have if you're investing in making loans to small businesses that are operating in wealthier, sort of higher profile, higher profitable retail corridors in different areas of the city or the state. And so we're doing that because that's why we exist. That's the mission. And we just need to manage very carefully how we do that, because that entails greater risk that we just have to watch out for. But our board of directors and our funders and all of our partners understand that we're going to take greater risks, and therefore we will have slightly higher losses than your normal financial institution. And that's okay, because we want to stretch. We want to help entrepreneurs that need it. And sometimes it's just hard to tell in cases where it's a marginal question on lending, whether or not we're going to get repaid or not, but we're many times going to do the loan anyway.
And how are the interest rates comparable to the more traditional banks?
We're certainly higher. So if you're an established business and you're talking to a bank, you would expect in this rate environment to be able to get a loan for, let's call it, so maybe 6%, and our rates will start more like 9. And so there is definitely a difference there where we try, at least in part, to cover some of that risk. But, I mean, frankly, we would have to charge something like 30, 40, 50%
yeah,
fully cover that, and we're absolutely not interested in doing anything of the sort, because we're a mission-based lender where we want to do good things for the neighborhoods we want to serve rather than take money out of those neighborhoods in the form of higher rates. So that's part of the gamble that we take, but we do that on purpose in order to provide good service to the entrepreneurs who are looking to grow.
And what would you say to the skeptics who believe maybe there's an underlining motive that's more profit driven for those who are running, your operation?
That's a great question.
Yeah,
because I think if you're observing a lending institution who is getting repaid with interest, you could quite rightly say, well, hold on. If you really care and you really want to help entrepreneurs grow, why don't you just give them the money? That's a perfectly valid question in my mind. The answer to that is that we're not satisfied with being able to help a handful of entrepreneurs based on whatever money we can raise and then give away. Instead, we want to help at scale as many entrepreneurs as we possibly can. And the only way to do that is to be able to recycle funds as fast as possible from places where we can get funding through us to an entrepreneur who then can use that funding in a way that will help them grow and become more profitable. But then they repay us so that we can then use that money to fund the next guy and the next woman and so forth. And if you don't do it that way, and if you don't have that interest spread, you don't have the principal to be repaid, then there's simply no way to continually grow in the service that you can provide. And we want to provide help for as many entrepreneurs as we can who are looking for it. So that's the logic, and I think that holds, but it's a debate that I've had on multiple occasions, and I'm sure I'll have it in the future.
Yeah, it is a logical set of questions to throw out there,
yeah.
And I'm wondering, when you say the mission and what you're trying to accomplish by giving as many people as possible, as many entrepreneurs as possible loans, why is that so important in your mind and Axion Chicago's mind that many people, as many as possible, can get loans for their businesses? Well, how does that help Chicago?
Yeah, that's right. It's the right question, I think. At the core of what we're doing, we're trying to create jobs and wealth in the neighborhoods that need both most. And so there are many ways to do that. Our belief is the most effective way to do that is to provide funding to help the entrepreneurs who are already in those neighborhoods, who are already running businesses, or who are looking to start businesses in those neighborhoods with the capital they need in order to create the jobs that will be in the neighborhood and stay in the neighborhood, And in doing so, if they run good businesses, then generate wealth for themselves and their family, which then they can reinvest in their own neighborhood in the form of buying things from other neighborhood entrepreneurs who are local. And so we've run the math and looked at the studies and so forth. What we found is that for every $2,000 that's invested in Axion, we in turn can invest in entrepreneurs to create or retain a job. And I've looked through my two previous jobs in Washington and at the city of Chicago. I can't find a more effective way to create jobs and that directed income increase in individuals who are living in underserved areas than that. If I could find one, then I'd invest in that instead, but I can't. This is, I think, the most effective way to do what we're trying to do. So, particularly in the areas where we spend most of our time, in Chicago we have challenges, which are to do with crime and poverty and lack of opportunity for a whole bunch of different ways. So our belief is that if you create more jobs and more wealth in those communities, that then that is the best way to help those communities grow, and that's to the benefit of the people who are there, and most importantly for the small business owners who are trying to enhance those communities by providing good businesses and good product and services to the people who live there.
So would you say this is sort of a community activism that is, business-driven?
Yeah, I mean, that's a decent way to describe it. I mean, it's a pretty hard-headed way to, numbers-driven, focused, bottom-line motivated way to help communities develop. And again, that's different from different models, and there are lots of good models that are out there that aren't this, and I'm fully supportive of many of those and have been working on many of those in the past. Things like workforce development or in the form of, say, job training or something like that. Good stuff. Creating affordable housing, really good stuff. Doing investments in streetscapes and the core infrastructure of places so that it's more efficient to be in a place, it's more beautiful to be in a place. Say parks and schools and things like that, particularly schools with education and public safety. All of those things are important and really powerful if done well. And so we think that what we're doing here is a necessary complement to all of those other sensible investments in neighborhoods by providing not just the people who are prepared to work, but the actual jobs that then will be available to those who are ready for them. And that, I think, is a crucial thing for us to be able to do more of in neighborhoods where people want to work and they just need an opportunity.
Okay. It sounds great, given the fact that we are a capitalistic society. Economics are a key component to our day-to-day, year-to-year existence. And poorer communities and neighborhoods, they don't have money so easily coming their way. And it sounds to me like you're providing that service and that need so that they could burgeon in their own neighborhood. They don't have to constantly stay stagnant economically. Now, I'm sure, you've been around, that a lot of people are skeptical right off the bat as soon as you start talking about anything to do with banking and lending, whether it be a nonprofit or not. They just automatically think bankers are going to take advantage and probably going to take advantage, of course, of people who are poorer and maybe not as well educated. That's got to be a challenge for you. And when people are looking at your books, are they going to see folks making millions of dollars off of these efforts? Or are they going to see a nice equity?
Let me try to state this in really precise terms. Our organization made $9,000 last year. So,
That's pretty clear.
that's about as precise a data point as I can provide.
Yes.
We are, like I said, we're a nonprofit, and our objective is to strike this really tough balance between scaling what we do in order to serve as many entrepreneurs as we possibly can, which requires capital and requires sound financing, requires smart pricing on product and all that. But balancing all that with us being dedicated towards, because it's our mission, providing as much assistance as possible to the neighborhoods we care about most. Now, to be clear, we serve all of Illinois and Northwest Indiana. We just have a particular focus on the city of Chicago because that's where the density of entrepreneurs are, and it's particularly where the need is greatest on the in the neighborhoods that I was describing before. So, yeah, to be blunt about it, nobody's making much money here. And we are able to attract really talented people to work here at Axion, not because we pay good salaries. I'll confess, as CEO, we don't. However, we bring people here because the work is really meaningful, and it's a hell of a lot of fun, too. And I say that because, look, we get to spend all day working with some of the smartest, scrappiest, resourceful people you'll ever meet, and the small business owners who are making it work in many cases, tough neighborhoods, and yet somehow they're still making good businesses and having those businesses thrive and whatever it is that they've chosen to do. And it's just naturally a daily invigorating thing to be able to work with people like that all over the city and the state and thereafter and Northwest Indiana as well. So it's good stuff. There's not much money in it, but that's okay. That's not why we're here.
Well, given the way you describe it, it's and being in Chicago, it sounds like a younger Michelle and Barack Obama would have definitely been employees to me. It sounds like it would be perfect for them.
I will not guess as to what they would have thought, but I would like to think, yeah, sure.
Yeah. Well, my compliments to what you're doing, Mr. McConnell, Brad, if I may. And I want to go a little bit into something that's, I guess, a prediction in your minor analysis from your expertise. Is microlending something that you think is going to become more and more of a norm across our continent, or across the United States, I should say?
You are listening to Troubadours and Raconteurs with E.W. Conundrum Demure on Radio Free Brooklyn.
That's a good question. Let me answer that in two ways. One is that microlending as a concept didn't originate in the States. It's most famously started in Bangladesh from a man named Muhammad Yunus, who won the Nobel Peace Prize for this a few years ago. And the structure of Latin America and Middle East and other places, Africa and places where microlending is really started, is much different than the structure that we typically see here and that what Axion has here in Chicago, where internationally you can think about the way that microlending works more along the lines of trust circles, where you sort of use peer pressure as the primary motivation for people to repay into the circle because it's everybody's collective cash that's circulating. Whereas here, and so you're talking about pennies on the dollar in sort of general terms in the amounts that each individual would be responsible for. Here it's just much different, in which we're more traditionally structured around underwriting loans, providing term loans that have very clear prices and lengths and obligations and such, because that's just what entrepreneurs in America are used to, and therefore we meet them where they are rather than expect them to get their head around a totally novel and different way to think about capital. Mm-hmm. So with that all that being said, there are already a number of very, very good microlenders that operate throughout the country. Axion Chicago is part of a broader network called Axion, which is part of an international network called Axion International, which actually started in Venezuela maybe 50-odd years ago. But so there's four of us. But then beyond that, there are really good microlenders in California and in the Southeast and a number of other places that have taken a very similar model to what we have here and worked with the local populations that were underserved in each of those places in order to provide them with the capital that the banks won't be able to provide otherwise. So that's, I guess that's one way to answer it. There is one final question, though, that is really important to try to answer the question properly, and that is, how do you go about trying to do more of something which loses money every time?
Good question.
And we lose money on every loan, and we do it on purpose. Okay, that's a tough model to scale because you require subsidy in order to fill in the gap, and so there's a limit to the amount of subsidy you can raise. So I'm spending a lot of time trying to think about, over the long term, how you go about solving for that conundrum, because it's, the tension between the mission that we have versus the economics of what we're doing. And provided that I and lots of other people who are smarter than me can kind of figure out how to deal with that conundrum, then I think that there's certainly plenty of entrepreneurs who are looking to grow who are struggling to find the attention they need from financial institutions. And so hopefully the answer to your question is yes, there will be a lot more of this, but there is an economic and philosophical question that has to be resolved in order for that to happen.
Great. Great answer. And I want to give you an opportunity to share a little contact information if you'd like, so people could learn more about Axion Chicago and maybe even get some assistance.
Yeah, well, I guess the easiest thing to do is to just Google us. but I need to spell it, and it's Accion Chicago. And so on our site, there is information about the things that we do, how to donate, how to participate. And in particular, I guess for people who are in Illinois and Northeast Indiana in particular. But then remember that there are Axions in other places, and there are lots of good microlenders in other places as well. At least specifically for Axion Chicago, we don't just lend. It's not just about money. We also provide free coaching and connections, meaning networking, to any entrepreneur who is just looking for something that they're not quite getting on their own in order to help them solve whatever problems in front of them, in order to help grow their business and hire more people and create more wealth in their neighborhoods.
And they'd have to be from Chicago? They'd have to be from Chicago area or Illinois to access?
Illinois, Northeast Indiana, in order to participate in that kind of coaching and connections. But obviously we have financial supporters from anywhere. It's at a click with a credit card. But I mention that in particular because we spend a lot of time working with partners who help to expand upon the services that we could provide as a scrappy nonprofit in order to provide more coaching, more opportunities to find suppliers and buyers that help our entrepreneurs grow. And so there's always opportunities to have people participate, even if it's not financial in nature, in order to help us with our mission, in order to help entrepreneurs do more that they want to do. So we're always up for that, and there's a way for people who are interested to use our website to inquire about how to be more helpful and sign up to be of assistance in that way if they're local.
I also wanted to talk to you about the hatchery. We only have a couple minutes left. I don't know if you'd be into just giving us a little brief tidbit about what the hatchery is. I understand it's more of a personal project.
No, this is actually... it's a fun one. It's a big deal. So we're, as I described at length here, a microlender. And so we focus on loans and coaching and connections specifically for entrepreneurs. We're a joint venture partner as a 50-50 with another great nonprofit in something that's related but very different in its own way. And this is called the Hatchery. The Hatchery is a food and beverage incubator on the west side of Chicago, which is under construction right now and will open at the end of the year. And in this, there's an opportunity here for anybody who's currently working on their own kitchen and has got an idea for a recipe or for whatever it might be in the food and beverage space. They're outgrowing their own kitchen. You know, their roommates or significant others have had enough with the kitchen being taken over with a small business that's about ready to launch. And yet, the entrepreneur isn't ready yet to make the big move towards an FDA-grade storefront space where you have to spend the $100,000 on build-out and all of that in order to get yourself situated. We provide that in this incubator, that middle space where you can get out of your own kitchen, go into a private rentable kitchen, which is already set up for you. Just walk in, pay the rent, and you're good. And then we help you, while you're in that space, to keep growing your business incrementally so that eventually you grow out. And then when you've got the sales revenue to generate to cover potential rent and the rest, then when you're ready, you can move out of that incubator into your own space and then grow your business further. It's a clear gap in what's available to entrepreneurs, frankly, anywhere, but particularly in Chicago. And so we're going to be solving for that. We're going to be doing it in a location which I think is traditionally been underserved for a very long time in Chicago. And we're going to then, as Axion, move our own operation there to be co-located with the hatchery so that we're the two tenants that are located on that site. And it's going to be really fun. So we've got a lot of great partners who are helping us to get this thing built. And once we get it done at the end of the year, then we'll be serving a lot more entrepreneurs and creating a lot more jobs than we would have been able to do otherwise.
That sounds wonderful. That sounds wonderful. And I guess that would be more for like food, as you mentioned, and maybe restaurants, microbreweries, things of that, wineries, things of that nature, soda, new soda groups.
I think mostly about people who have a really good recipe, who know how to make something, and they're trying to figure out how to scale what they make so they can sell more of it. So think about the people who are trying to get their products on the shelves in the national supermarkets. And it's hard to do that out of your own kitchen, because you got to make enough in order for you to be able to fulfill a contract. And yet we have lots of opportunities at Whole Foods and Mariano's and lots of other chains that are the biggest around here in Illinois, where they want to support the local food entrepreneurs, and yet they have to have an entrepreneur who can make enough in order for them to justify creating the shelf space. So there's a lot of that type of business, thinking about it both on the food and on the beverage side. And then there are people who just want to start a restaurant or that want to start a microbrewery or whatever that might be, and they need an interim space to develop their products for that too. So it's everything in between.
Excellent. Brad McConnell, CEO of Axion Chicago, thank you so much for sharing really an inspirational set of projects and ideas that you're emerged within. Anybody who's listening might be motivated to start their own version of what you're doing, and maybe neighborhoods across many cities will feel the rejuvenation, as I'm sure Chicago is. So thank you so much for what you're doing, and thank you so much for sharing your time and energy with us on Troubadours and Rock on Tours.
Oh, this is fun. Thanks for giving me the time and for the great work you're doing here.
Thank you. Have a good one.
Okay, bye.
You give me some. It's too hot for habits. My patience is done with me. I wanna live in times that touch. I wanna stay when my temper beats.
Notebooks of Brady O'Leary. The newspaper in the depressed former coal town where I worked as a copy boy was a stable of eccentrics, more front page than all the president's men. There were, of course, the reporters, from young cubs angling for scoops to grizzled veterans who chomped cigars, drank their coffee black, and punched out stories two-fingered on manual typewriters. There were the copy boys, who ranged from burgeoning reporters to teenagers who seemed to have wandered into the newsroom from the street and settled into an office chair near the teletype machine. There were typesetters in the back room, a a quietly strange lot, and there was a large red-headed janitor who uttered gnomic comments when emptying the garbage cans, and whose swagger almost put him on equal footing with the managing editor. Of all the eccentrics, my favorite was Brady O'Leary. He was a classic reporter. He wanted to be a novelist. He always brought books with him to his shifts, and reading the spines of his evolving library was an education in itself. Vladimir Nabokov, John Updike, Saul Bellow, Richard Yates. He read the heavy hitters of his generation. He read the classics. He read The New Yorker. He read literary journals and reviews. He would regularly share a passage or two with me. The first paragraph of Lolita, say, or a sequence describing the movement of a train in Nabokov's King, Queen, Knave, or a particularly juicy section on the escapades of Updike's Randy Suburbanites. He aimed for a style like those of his heroes, and so he was bound to be disappointed. Brady wrote novels during the day, or in the middle of the night, and on the night shift at the paper, he covered sewer board and school board and city council meetings, fires, the occasional murder, human interest, and holiday stories. He did the perennials, what's happening this year on the 4th of July, or Thanksgiving, or Labor Day, a new doomed animal at the zoo, the opening of a soup kitchen. And he was now and then dragooned into writing obits, receiving the life stories of deceased townsfolk over the phone from a funeral director with two whiskey sours in him calling from a booth at a bar. I wouldn't say he hated every minute of his newspaper duties. He was a reporter, after all, and relished stories of all kinds. But I'm sure he regretted the time spent interviewing a local blowhard politician that could have been fruitfully expended on his latest novel. Brady dressed the part of a mid-century male novelist, with striped shirts and wide ties. A tad frayed, though. And he was a spirited character around the newsroom, amusing editors, reporters, copyboys, and the oddball citizens who were always stopping by to inform, complain, promote themselves, or curry favor. He would impersonate or mock officials, read the grocery ads in the Sunday papers with a step-and-fetch-it dialect. I told you he was from benighted mid-century stock. For the pleasure of a few, he wrote and performed filthy skits starring the few women on staff, most of them taking place on a train and involving the antics of a disorderly porter and a lecherous passenger. He had an eye for the ladies, as they used to say, and his ex-wife was reportedly an exotic beauty, British, if I remember correctly. He had two children, boys, one a reader, one not, as he told me once when one of my duller copyboy colleagues wrote, to my horror, all over the cover of my current paperback. The dull copyboy reminded him of his one son. If he was not exactly a mentor to me, he was an invaluable source of information, about books especially, and he treated me like an equal, sharing literary discoveries and handing me reviews of new titles. And a few times he gave me the manuscripts of his novels and stories he was working on. He would place a thick ream of paper in front of me and say, "Tell me what you think." I was honored, intrigued, and uneasy. What if I didn't like his book? What would I say? Well, obviously, even if I didn't like or totally comprehend his work, I would say that I did. Unfortunately, I was disappointed. Something was missing in the stories of love affairs gone bad, classic mid-century male novelist subject matter, but I couldn't quite say what. Now and then I would come upon a phrase I liked. One character held his lover's breast like a light bulb. And I would focus on the phrase when he eventually cornered me for a response. He was as disappointed in my stammering comments as I was in my reading. What his stories lacked was life. They sounded too literary and secondhand, not nearly as fresh and funny and real as his stories in conversation, or even his dirty skits, or his notebooks. In between talking to his colleagues, reading the paper or his books, and reluctantly knocking off a story on deadline, he jotted thoughts for future stories and novels in his small reporter's notebook. Since he would leave them in full view on his desk, the copy boys felt it their duty to peruse them when he went out on a story or off to dinner. They were filled with incisive comments and acute details culled from nights at the paper. One entry read, "In the novel, there must be a Chizik." That consonant-crammed Eastern European name appeared seemingly every few weeks in the obit pages, as if our town minted and dispatched Chizik's with wild abandon, saddening the remaining Chizik's and challenging the obit writer to spell the dead one's name correctly. I don't know if Brady ever published a book. His great subject was right there in his notebook pages, and sadly, remained there.
A buzzer took a monkey for a ride in the air. The monkey thought that everything was on the square. The buzzer tried to throw the monkey off of his back, but the monkey grabbed his neck and said, "Now listen, Jack. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top. Ain't no use in diving. What's the use of jiving? Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top." The buzzer told the monkey, "You are choking me. Release your hold and I will set you free." The monkey looked the buzzer right dead in the eye and said, "Your story is so touching, but it sounds just like a lie. Straighten up and fly right. Straighten up and stay right. Straighten up and fly right. Cool down, Papa, don't you blow your top." Papa, don't you blow your top. Fly right.
Freakin' Mall. Columbine, Sandy Hook, Parkland, Newtown, World War III, President takes a dump in a lump, basket empty, thin-haired, simple thief, Trump, just another gear in the oppressive machine, I fear. I am innocuous and unconsciously subservient to it all. As I write this on the back of a flyer, sitting in a chain at the freaking mall. Thank you.
And there you have it, episode 260 of Troubadours and Raconteurs. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Chief Executive Officer, and I like to call him a business-driven community activist, Brad McConnell. Thank you so much for sharing with us your experience, your insight, and your vision. I'd also like to thank our associate producer and resident essayist, Dr. Michael Pavese, a.k.a. Uncle Cesare, for writing another wonderful piece. And I'd like to thank these musical artists as well. Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Courtney Barnett, The Doors, Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down, Nat King Cole, Vassar Clements, Branford Marsalis, and Terrence Blanchard II. Until next week, enjoy this one. Thanks for listening.